This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, Mali's prime minister and his government have resigned 4 weeks after a massacre of almost 160 Fulani herders by ethnic vigilante group shocked the nation. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi could stay in office until 2030 with expanded powers if voters approve constitutional amendments this weekend. And Zimbabwe is marking the anniversary of its 1980 independence from Britain today. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Mali's Prime Minister Soumilou Boboye Maiga and his entire government stepped down yesterday amid a surge in violence, including a massacre last month of 160 Fulani herders by suspected Dogon hunters. A statement from President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita's office said he accepts the resignations. There had been talks of a vote of no confidence in the government. The United Nations reports that over the past year, fighting between the Fulani and the Dogon community has left some 600 women, children, and men dead. 2 weeks ago, there was a massive demonstration in Bamako, the capital, to protest the government's inability to curb the violence. Mali has been struggling to restore stability ever since Islamic extremists took advantage of a brief military coup in Bamako in 2012 to seize much of northern Mali. French forces largely drove them out several months later, but a number of jihadists are still active and some violence continues despite the presence of UN peacekeepers. Leaders of Sudan's continuing protests are putting pressure on the transitional military council that replaced ousted President Omar al-Bashir. The protesters announced plans to form their own civilian council to force Sudan's military to give up power. Naba Mohadin reports from Khartoum that thousands more protesters joined an ongoing sit-in today outside the defense ministry. The main protest group, the Sudanese Professional Association, has said it would form a civilian council to replace the military one. Yesterday, the group issued a written statement saying nominees would be announced soon. The statement added that a civilian presidential council would be formed and a transitional legislative council would include 40% women. Ever since April 6th, social media has been saturated with images of young Sudanese demonstrators demanding a peaceful transition to democracy outside army headquarters in Khartoum. Indeed, this uprising has been led mostly by youth, most of whom have only known the tight-fisted Islamist rule of Omar al-Bashir. Bashir was ousted by a military coup on April 11th, largely as a response to the protests which began in earnest last December. To find out why youth are playing such a key role in this historic event, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with 25-year-old Mazin Khalil. Khalil is both a graduate student in Brooklyn, New York, and the co-executive director of the activist group Sudanese Americans for Nonviolent Demonstrations.
So this is a youth revolution, first and foremost, because of social media. The technology that's available in Sudan right now, such as WhatsApp and Twitter and even Instagram, which our grandparents and our forefathers didn't have access to, has been predominantly youth-led. The youth have been the ones who have been coordinating these protests that are happening. They have been the ones who have been getting people out into the streets. They've been the ones who have been rushing the people to the hospitals when they've been injured and even offering their services, such as, freelance, if you want to call it that, ambulatory military, paramedic. The youth have been the ones that have been doing that.
I noticed that all of the protesters who have died since December have been under 30, except one. Why are so many youth on the vanguard?
It stems from the frustration of the youth themselves to want to see a change happening in Sudan.
I know unemployment is an aspect. How is that tied to the old regime?
So it's the connection between unemployment and the old regime is that there's a lot of nepotism that occurs. So if you're friends of the old regime, or you know somebody in the old regime, or you know you belong to the same political party, you're going to get the jobs. That's very unfortunate because you have people who are very qualified that are not able to do the jobs that they were trained for. You have medical school students who can't be doctors. You have lawyers who can't practice law because they don't have that connection there.
At one point, you told me that the youth activism is at least partly fueled by the nostalgia of the parents' generation.
Part of this is the fact that, you know, we want to bring Sudan to what our parents envisioned it to be. Just the beauty of what Sudan was like when they speak about, you know, being able to go into the streets and how the quality of education that used to be in Sudan and, you know, the job value. We want to be able to experience that, but we aren't able to, unfortunately. And I guess we're showing the older generations that we can do it, you know, and that we're going to bring the change about that you saw and that we also want to see as well.
And many say that women have contributed hugely to this uprising.
Absolutely. The women are the ones who are coming up with these amazing chants. They're the ones who are leading people in chants, standing up there and, you know, they're like, yeah, we got to keep going and we have to push forward. So this is definitely a youth-led and woman-led revolution.
Is there one quote or chant that you can share with us that it talks about women's inclusion?
There's a beautiful Arabic quote that says, if you've taught a man, you've taught one person, but if you've taught a woman, you've taught a nation. And I think that is exactly shown here in the Sudanese revolution.
Do you think that the sort of international global trend for youth empowerment and inclusion and all that has become part of the Sudanese youth way of looking at things?
Absolutely. I think the globalization has, you know, many positives to it. And one of the positives in this case is that we're looking at things in a completely different way. We're thinking about it in terms of how can we bring marginalized voices to the forefront, whether that be the people of Darfur who have experienced a very terrible genocide under this regime, whether that be women who were maybe marginalized because of their gender and things like that.
Have you been taking your cues or from the recent history of the Arab Spring in 2011? I mean, I know that there was also a hope there, of course, for a transition from the military or strongman rule to democracy.
We have not. There's a consensus among youth online and the diaspora that we want to identify as African and hold on to our African roots rather than take anything from the Arab Spring, because it would just be the same brainwashing that occurred in Sudan. We're bringing together our vision of what we want Sudan to actually be like. This breadbasket vision that we always read when historians talk about Sudan, we're able to finally bring that to fruition. And it feels like, yes, we're getting there, you know? I'm really proud of what the youth have done. I'm really proud of the fact that we understand that the work is not yet complete and that we're still willing to work.
Smells like youth spirit, doesn't it?
I hope it's not just youth spirit, and I hope it's changed, that we don't just get tired and become complacent after seeing all this and just, you know, continue driving forward.
That was 25-year-old graduate student Mazin Khalil, who co-directs Sudanese Americans for Nonviolent Demonstrations. Khalil spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. The UN Refugee Agency reports 163 refugees from sub-Saharan Africa who had been detained in horrific conditions in Libya have been flown out of the battle-scarred country to safety in Niger. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The plane landed in Niger's capital, Niamey, early Friday. This was the first such flight out of Libya since fighting in the capital, Tripoli, escalated 2 weeks ago. The UN Refugee Agency reports the refugees aboard the plane had been detained in facilities close to the conflict front lines. UNHCR spokesman Barbara Balor says his agency was able to secure their release along with that of more than 300 other refugees within the past 2 weeks. He tells VOA the UNHCR is very concerned for the safety of some 3,000 refugees and migrants who remain trapped inside these facilities, exposed to the escalating violence. The refugees, he says, have fled persecution and violence from countries such as Eritrea, Mali, Nigeria, Sudan, and Somalia.
As fighting moves closer to these detention centers, the worry is these refugees could be very, very close to a situation of life and death. That's why it's very important that we are able to secure the release of all those who are in these detention facilities and then try to make sure that they are moved to a safe and secure location.
The World Health Organization reports more than 200 people have been killed since clashes erupted 2 weeks ago when troops commanded by a rogue general moved to capture Tripoli. The refugees who flew to Niger Friday include dozens of women and children. The UNHCR says it is urgently seeking states that will accept them and other refugees from previous flights for resettlement. Since November 2017, the UNHCR has been able to relocate around 2,800 people from Libya to Niger. So far, places of resettlement have been found for nearly half of them. The rest remain in Niamey, waiting for a country willing to give them a home. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi could stay in office until 2030 with expanded powers if voters approve constitutional amendments this weekend. Backers say Sisi deserves more time to implement changes, including reforms that have bolstered the economy. Critics say he has cracked down on dissent and other freedoms. Parliament approved the amendments this week, with only 22 of the 596 legislators voting against them. The proposals would expand the presidential term from 4 to 6 years, requires a minimum of 25% of parliament to be women, creates a second legislative body, and allows the president to name one or more vice presidents along with head judges and a public prosecutor. Voting begins today for Egyptians outside the country and for the next 3 days for the ones inside Egypt. Uganda's Supreme Court has upheld the Constitutional Court ruling that allowed the removal of the age limit from Uganda's constitution. Opposition legislators who petitioned the Supreme Court called the ruling unfortunate, saying justice did not prevail. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
President Yoweri Museveni has been given a green light to contest Uganda's presidency in 2021, even after the age of 75. Uganda's Supreme Court Thursday upheld a constitutional court ruling in 2018 that stated Museveni, elected for the fourth time in 2016, could run. Led by Chief Justice Bart Katureba, Justice Eldad Mwangutsia read the final court ruling.
By majority decision of 4-3, on the process of enactment of the act fails. On the violence CAFO inside and outside parliament fails. On the substantiality test fails. By unanimous decision of the court on the vacation of office by the president after attaining the age of 75 fails. The decision of the constitutional court is upheld.
The Supreme Court sought to consider 8 key issues. Pertinent among others is whether the majority of justices on the Constitutional Court erred in holding that the entire process of conceptualizing, debating, and enacting the Constitutional Amendment Act that removed the age limit did not contravene the Constitution and rules of procedure of Parliament. They also considered whether Constitutional Court justices erred when they held that the removal of the age limit was not consistent with the Constitution, and whether Constitutional Court justices erred when they held that the violence and scuffle inside and outside Parliament during the enactment contravened the Constitution. The ruling by 4 out of 7 justices was contrary to 3 justices who found the process leading to the age limit amendment was null and void and contravened Uganda's Constitution. Justices who ruled in favor of the appellants also argued that the certificate of compliance accompanying the bill was defective because it contained unmentioned provisions and that the president had a duty to bring them to the attention of the speaker before assenting to it. Opposition legislator and petitioner Winfred Kiza expressed disappointment that the Supreme Court sanctified illegalities instead of saving the country.
When they say beating up people was not okay, but was not so serious to warrant a violation of the law. Did they want people to be killed for them to really understand the magnitude of the violence? Oh my God, why did we even spend our time debating these issues and yet these issues are held irrelevant? It's unfortunate.
Deputy Attorney General Mwesigwe Rukutana, representing the government, was elated by the Supreme Court ruling, describing it as the rule of law and democracy at work.
I appeal to our colleagues, when you lose, you get disappointed. But even when you are disappointed, it's incumbent upon you to respect the court ruling. This is the final opportunity to challenge the outcome. The Constitutional Amendment Act No. 2 is now law on the books of Uganda.
Critics say with such court rulings, Ugandans have no option but to take the streets to see a change in government. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Mali's prime minister and his government have resigned 4 weeks after a massacre of almost 160 Fulani herders by ethnic vigilante group shocked the nation. In Sudan, the protesters have announced plans to form their own civilian council to convince Sudan's military to give up power. And 163 refugees from sub-Saharan Africa who had been detained in horrific conditions in Libya have been flown to safety in Niger. And Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi could stay in office until 2030 with expanded powers if voters approve constitutional amendments this weekend. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Zimbabwe is marking the anniversary of its 1980 independence from Britain today. The anniversary coincides with efforts to heal the wounds brought about by state-sanctioned massacres in the 1980s in which thousands of people died. In one of the most affected areas, Soloso, people are opening up about reburial efforts and what they are seeking from the government. Columbus Mavunga reports.
The Rocholocho area, about 600 kilometers southwest of Harare, is one of the places most affected by the state-sanctioned massacres. Human rights organizations say some 20,000 people were killed during the massacres which took place when Robert Mugabe was president. Local resident Melwa Ngwenya says a recent decision by the government of current President Emmerson Mnangagwa to allow victims in shallow or mass graves to be reburied is not something to celebrate on this Independence Day. Ngwenya says his son was beaten to death during the massacres when Mnangagwa was state security minister. The killings were known as Gukura Hundi. Ngwenya says the president is not being sincere and that is blindfolding us to make us happy, yet we are not happy. It's painful, my child, says Ngwenya. He also says the president is trying to silence us. He says, we want compensation. If he cares about our cries and the government cares about us and has sympathy, it must build me at least a two-bedroom house, said Ngwenya. According to Ngwenya, the army assaulted his son, Sibangani, who died along with other 8 villagers. Ngwenya says they were buried in a shallow grave about 5 kilometers from the family home 3 days later. I do not usually come to this place, says Ngwenya. I feel sorrow and pain since he died without falling sick. for the pain and sorrow to go, I have to be given something to console me. A two-bedroomed house will console my spirit that, yes, my son has died, but my tears have been rubbed off. He also says, I want to have a place to mourn my son, not something edible as it goes away, but a permanent structure, something to stay in, said Ngwenya. On the eve of Zimbabwe independence, the president said on state TV that citizens were now free to talk about Gukurahundi.
The question of Gukurahundi, we don't see, and personally I don't see anything wrong in debating it on television, in newspapers, on the platforms. Let us debate it. In fact, we feared nothing. There was nothing to fear about the debate. Actually, it's critical that we have that debate. Some of the issues that are there could have been resolved a long time back. Gukurahundi has nothing to do with other people. It's an internal issue which we must discuss as Zimbabweans. It has happened among ourselves.
A rights organization, Ibechu Likazulu, has been vocal in calling for the Gukurahundi issue to be discussed. Its secretary, Mbuso Fuzwayo, says Mnangagwa has to deal with more than just allowing people to discuss the issue of the massacres and reburials openly.
It's not those who are in Musqueam and Chalukreps who are going to prepare it, but those, everyone needs to prepare it. Everyone will have peace when he is sure where his father is lying, where his son or daughter is lying. He doesn't talk about women who were raped. So he's talking about half of what has been, what happened. But it's a Gukurahundi is a complex subject.
Now it remains to be seen if the government has the will and funds to accommodate the people's demands on Gukurahundi. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Cholocho, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondence reports around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information. Stand up!